You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It might be cold outside, but we recently got a question that brought us right back to summer. Alexi wrote into WPR's Why Wisconsin Project asking when Wisconsin Dells and the Wisconsin Dells tourism area was built. That got us wondering about the history of the Dells and how it became to be the water park and resort town it is today. And it also got us curious about your memories of the Dells. Rob Cunningham lives in Madison now, but he grew up there in the Dells. His family had a small motel, and he remembers when two pilots stayed with him in the 1970s.
And they'd stay there for the summer and work as tour pilots for the helicopters. And my brother and I used to like to go down and watch those helicopters take off and land. And one day when they were kind of slow, one of the pilots asked us if we wanted to go up for a ride. And so we did. My parents had no idea that we did that. And I do know that they had mentioned we shouldn't get in cars with people that we didn't know, but I don't think they ever mentioned a helicopter. So we probably thought we were fine.
We want to hear your Dells memories at 800-642-1234. Is there a favorite memory that sticks out to you? Did you grow up there? Did you go there for vacations? Maybe growing up, continue a tradition with your family? You have a favorite water park or water slide? Have you worked there? What's it like from that side of the slide? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave Rambo is the site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum, a historical site in Wisconsin Dells. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Wonderful day out here today.
Excellent. Well, let's go back to the early days of European settlement. I understand the city wasn't originally called Wisconsin Dells. Why not?
Yeah. Well, it's a long story, of course, as most stories are. The man who founded the city and was responsible for putting it here was a man named Byron Kilbourne, who was a railroad mogul. And he was not a modest man. So he founded this city in 1857 and named it after himself, Kilbourne City. And it stayed that way until 1931 when, you know, tourism traffic, people were looking for Wisconsin Dells. They weren't looking for Kilbourne City. So it just made it a little easier for them to find.
Can you talk about what it is? Wisconsin has a lot of great scenery. What was it about the Dells that really captured people and made them want to take the trip there by rail or boat or car?
Well, we have this incredible, otherworldly-looking riverbanks, and it's sand rock that started as, you know, sand on the floor of an inland sea and has been compacted over hundreds of thousands of years. And it's just fantastic. For many, many years, the Ho-Chunk were here, and they have... They still remain here, and they gather here oftentimes to kind of revitalize themselves spiritually and mentally and emotionally. So it was a place of peace. This was really, really well known, but the original city of the Wisconsin Dells, or then known Kilbourne City, was mainly a little logging and lumbering town, and it took quite a while for it to develop into, you know, what we know it as today.
When did we first start to see this rise in tourism associated with the Dells?
Well, the first we know of is, it came from kind of one man's aha moment. The fellow was named Leroy Gates, and he was a river pilot. He began as a lumber raft person. He guided those bundled wooden planks, you know, the logs from the rivers up north through the tricky waters of the Dells to go down to market. And he began to make show of his skills. He had a top hat and a coat, and he had the foresight to kind of show how he could live off the river beyond rafting. In 1857, he turned his knowledge of the waterway into a business, showing visitors the scenery of the Dells by rowboat. And he had two or three passengers, and he would go up and down. And oftentimes I've been told he made up a lot of fanciful stories, you know, as it went. So that began, you know, the scenic river tours. And by the 1870s, daily excursions were offered to visitors, mostly still by rowboats. But by 1871, steamboats came in here and today, I think it's a fleet of around 22 steel launches that still give those same tours.
Talking to Dave Rambo, site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum, a historical site in Wisconsin Dells. We're answering a Why Wisconsin question about why Wisconsin Dells became what it is, the tourist history of the community that brings people in from so far and wide. You can join in with your questions or your memories at 800-642-1234, whether you grew up there or lived there at some point, have fond memories of vacationing there, fond or otherwise memories of working there at some point. Love to hear those too at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Kristen Day, who lives in Hartford, spends her weekends as a seasonal camper in the Dells with her husband. Kristen says her childhood camping memories inspired her to keep camping there to this day.
When I was a kid, I grew up camping every weekend at the Dells. My family had a camper at a campground. So did my cousins. So we had built-in friends. And we would go up there every weekend to the Dells and just be there. And it's just, it's such a different environment. I know it's touristy and there's a lot that goes on. But for me, it's the nature, it's the river, it's the history, all of those things that kind of make it old Dells.
Yeah, and it is. There's a lot of the tourist things there now. We're going to get into those in a bit. But people like Kristen certainly still, Dave, go there for the scenery.
Yeah, it's an authentic experience. And I'm right downtown here on this bustling Broadway, which is our main street. And just a block or two away on the river, it's nice and calm and peaceful. You know, you're carried away from that very, very quickly. Especially, you know, if you're on one of the boats, you can get away up the river or down the river. And, you know, that's part of the experience that was and still is today.
Now, I want to get to know a historical figure that definitely on your radar, Dave. You work the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum. H.H. Bennett, a photographer who really told the world in a lot of ways about the Dells. Could you share some of his story with us?
Oh, geez, where do I start? he came here with his uncle and his brother in 1857 as a teenager. And he was in 1857, right when, you know, the Dells was getting the railroad and kind of coming to be what it was at that time. He got caught up in the fervor of the Civil War. He became a soldier. And during his service in 1864, he was injured. And his right hand was, you know, really injured badly. He came back without a job, didn't know what he was going to do, and he ran into our friend Leroy Gates. And Leroy, besides being this pilot, also ran a little tin-type shop down on one of the corners here on Broadway. And he rented that business to Mr. Bennett, and the legend was born from there. Bennett became a photographer, and along with his wife, did portraits here in the downtown area. And Bennett had this kind of wayward feeling. He had to go out. He couldn't just do these portraits. So he started going up and down the river and doing landscape photos, which really is what he became very famous for in later years.
And those in turn, as I understand it, Dave, helped make the Dells famous.
Right. Bennett was, I think, ahead of his time, he and his family. While his wife, Frankie, ran the studio business, he made sure prints of his photos got onto the railroads that traveled through, the passenger trains, as well as he gave sets of photographs in the form of 3D stereo cards to different libraries so people all around the country could see this wonderful area and want to come see it for themselves.
We're talking to Dave Rambo, site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum, a historical site in Wisconsin Dells. He's with us today to give us some of the early history of the Dells in response to a question we got through our Why Wisconsin project. Up next, we'll fast forward and talk about the rise of water parks and some of the more recent history. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you go to the Dells to this day for your vacations? What's your favorite season to go there? Or do you have memories maybe of going there as a kid? Going there, maybe you grew up there. What was it like living where everybody wanted to be, especially in the summertime? Have you worked there? Do you work there? Do you run a business there? Love to hear your piece of Wisconsin Dells history. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the history of the Wisconsin Dells in response to a question we got through our Why Wisconsin project. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, your own memories and experiences of the Dells at 800-642-1234. Dave Rambo stays with us. And now Rhonda Parsham joins us with some recent Dells history. She's director of marketing communications at the Wisconsin Dells Visitor and Convention Bureau. Rhonda, thanks for joining us.
Hi, happy to be here.
Well, Dave's been giving us some of the earlier history of Wisconsin Dells. When did we start to see the rise of the water parks that a lot of us associate with the area?
Oh, yes. So water slides first made an appearance in our area back in the 70s. But it wasn't until really the first indoor water park was born in 1989, right here in the Dells, when things really started to get interesting. The fact that we could offer an option to swim, splash, slide down water slides all year long in Wisconsin was a real game changer. And so as more and more water parks were developed, that really gave us a point of differentiation to other Midwest destinations. So we really embraced that as a community and eventually took on that moniker that everyone hears now of the water park capital of the world.
Yeah, I don't know of another contender. Can you remind us why this is a pretty legit title for the Dells, water park capital of the world?
Yeah, so we've got a couple things we can lay claim to. Today, we still have more water parks here of every size per capita than anywhere else on the planet. We have more than 200 water slides, over 16 million gallons of water. And as mentioned, we are home to the United States' first indoor water park, but also home to America's largest outdoor water park, which is Noah's Ark. Also America's largest indoor-outdoor combination water park at Wilderness Resort. And also Wisconsin's largest indoor water park at Kalahari Resort. And actually, a fun little tidbit, National Water Park Day was instituted right here in Wisconsin Dells by our own very well-known Kalahari Resorts. So that's a day we love to celebrate each year on July 28th.
And Rhonda, before I let you go, how big a deal is tourism for the local economy today?
It's huge. It's really the backbone of our community. It's not just water slides and attractions, but it boosts our local economy, employs thousands of people, supports infrastructure and education. It also enriches our area businesses and creates economic development throughout our community. So very important.
Rhonda, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rhonda Parsham from the Wisconsin Dells Visitor and Convention Bureau. Dave Rambo stays with us from the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum Historical Site in Wisconsin Dells. Let's go to your calls now with Timothy in Minnesota. Timothy, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Timothy?
I've been going to the Dells since I was a little kid. I grew up about 45 minutes away in Wisconsin Rapids. I think we used to go to Familyland, which I think now is like Zeus themed, but it's across from Noah's Ark. And then as time passed, I started going to Noah's Ark. I think the story I wanted to share was I was surprised going back as an adult because you find, I guess this would be with all sorts of big parks, not just water parks, but you spend time with lots of strangers, you know, lots of other people. And because it's water parks, you see a lot of people as you normally wouldn't see them. And what I was surprised by was you actually see quite a variety of tattoos that you don't see otherwise. So that's kind of a fun, unexpected element of the experience.
I love it. Another angle of people watching. Dave, for the first tourists in Wisconsin Dells, when it first started to get big, 100 years before water slides were a thing,
right,
do we have a lot of memories, letters that they wrote or photos of that first wave of tourists in the Dells area?
We do. Now, handheld photography, where people bring their own cameras, started in like the late 1880s and 1890s. So you see a real boom of that type of photography activity here, where people are taking fun pictures of themselves and their families. That became lean times for people like Mr. Bennett, who did a lot of his work with portraiture. But he kind of shifted gears, and he and his family started doing things, a thing called the penny postcard. And what they did is they took some of his more famous landscapes, converted them into postcard format, and you see a lot of people writing each other, you know, the usual wish you were here. But then others will be writing, you know, really good narratives on what they were doing here in the Dells, and it's really fascinating to read some of that, what was going on 100 years ago.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go to Pam now in Viroqua. Pam, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hey, I have some great memories from the Wisconsin Dells during the 60s, and I was a kid then, and my parents made a point of getting us up to Wisconsin Dells one weekend every summer, and the big the thing that excited me the most was Fort Dells.
Fort Dells.
Fort Dells was a Fort Dells was a it was a amusement park for kids that wasn't with slides and that kind of stuff. But we had a it was a Western theme, and there was the bad guy Black Bart, and shootouts and things like that. There was a fort that you could run around in.
Interesting. Pab, thanks a lot. I'm guessing that doesn't reflect the Wild West days of Wisconsin Dells of yore. That said, Dave, what were some of the first amenities, apart from, you know, those rowboat tours that started to pop up early on?
Of course, you know, cottage industries bloomed, where people would come here and they'd need a place to stay. And so local people started offering their homes, or more than not, building little cottages up along the bluffs and in the valleys where people could stay. Bennett and his family were kind of an unofficial chamber of commerce at that time. So if you'd come down to his store here on Broadway and ask where some of these amenities were, where could you find a good place to go fishing? Where could you find a good place to stay? Where's the best steak in town? Or something like that. You know, those amenities were available. And, of course, he'd lead you to good friends of his, you know, that he knew that ran some of those things.
Our own Stephanie Elkins from Morning Classics on WPR has some fond memories of the Dells. Here's a listen.
Our teenage nieces and nephews each came to Wisconsin by themselves over the years, and a trip to the Dells became a rite of passage. Racing go-karts, plunging into the river and the ducks, and calling home to beg permission for bungee jumping. But my favorite memories linger from the Tommy Bartlett Thrill Show, enjoying some of the best water skiers in the country as the sun went down, followed by an old-fashioned variety show complete with spinning plates. The kids would relax, light up, and laugh outdoors on perfect summer nights.
That's Stephanie Elkins. And Dave, you know, we've got the water shows now. I didn't realize how far they went back. You mentioned the first water shows was a guy in a top hat on his log raft.
Right.
did we start using the water for entertainment beyond just showing my log rafting skills?
You know, as things grew, we started seeing notable figures that were coming here to take the tours up and down the Wisconsin Dells and on steamboats, which, you know, at one time there were more than three boat companies that were doing business up here. In 1918, they made a law. The business was getting so competitive that they wouldn't let people hawk the tickets on the street. And so they sent their people out to the bridge when you got into town, and they'd jump on the running boards of the cars to see who could be the first to sell the tickets to the boats that were here. We had, at one time, I think in 1881, Buffalo Bill Cody brought his group here. And so this was such a notable place to, you know, for water tourism on the river, that, you know, we saw a lot of visitation here for that.
Let's go back to our callers. Kay is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Kay, hi.
Hi. How are you? I grew up in the Dells, then moved away and came back here, and then was editor of the Dells paper for 20 years. The Dells paper, interestingly, was the first business to change its name from Kilbourne to Wisconsin Dells, but there are still places in town where you see the Kilbourne name, like on the library and the fire department. And also, I had people walk into our office that would say something that they were surprised to see that people live there.
But somebody's got it, right, Kay?
Yes, some of us do. I live out of town, but we do.
Kay, thanks a lot for sharing that. Let's get one more quick call in here. Becky is with us in Hustisford. Becky, hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. My first memories of the Dells go back long before I was born. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, the Ashland area, and my mother and father were from the Superior area. My mother had polio when she was young, and as I was growing up, she would tell me wonderful stories of her experience going to a place called Camp Wabik in the Dells area, which was a very special camp for children with disabilities that allowed them to have a camping experience as rustic as possible. She went there in the late 40s or early 50s, and I looked forward eagerly to visiting the Dells and was very delighted to do so as an adult.
Wow.
Because of the stories my mother told.
That's a great story. Becky, thanks for that call. And Dave, thanks to you for sharing your stories as well. Really appreciate your time.
Anytime.
That's Dave Rambo, site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum in the Wisconsin Dells, with us today to answer a Why Scotsman question about the history of the Dells. We also heard from Rhonda Parsham with the Wisconsin Dells Visitors and Convention Bureau. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, new inflation numbers are out. They're still high. We'll find out what's driving prices and the prospects that they might slow down. And you can join in with your thoughts and experiences. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we want to hear from you with your new cooking plans for 2022. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the latest state and national voting news with debates and lawsuits and more in the works. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the races for governor and U.S. Senate in Wisconsin are taking shape. We'll go through the candidates, the issues, and the party dynamics in this year's election. First, we're looking at state and national voting policy news as the 2022 midterms approach. The Wisconsin Elections Commission says that state Republicans have made the largest ever request for voter data, so large it will be effectively impossible to complete. Wisconsin Republicans are also pushing against the use of ballot drop boxes. Three lawsuits are underway, as well as a push for rule changes from the state legislature. On the national scale, President Biden is pushing to get his two voting bills passed, though the filibuster will likely have to be overturned in order for that to happen, which today looks unlikely. We're talking about the latest news on voting in Wisconsin and around the country, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the tensions between Republican lawmakers here in the state and the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission? Do you think there needs to be a large-scale review of voter data before the fall election, as Republicans have requested? How about ballot drop boxes, a big particular issue lately? Should they be allowed? What should the rules be if so, or do you not like them? Do you want to see federal laws changed, which looks, again, not that likely as the way things currently look at the Senate anyhow? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Lots of news out there related to voting laws. Let's zoom in on Wisconsin first, Kathleen, and these ballot drop boxes in particular. As I mentioned, three lawsuits, movement in the state legislature trying to clarify rules. What are your thoughts on the rise of ballot drop boxes this year and the role they play?
Well, ballot drop boxes are a tool that some localities around the country had used even before the 2020 election, but they became much more popular and much more important during the global pandemic. And if you remember, in November of 2020, that was before we had a vaccine. So we were in a place in the pandemic where people were told to distance, not to gather. And so in-person voting became less attractive to people. And so ballot drop boxes were a safe and convenient way for people to vote. Because of former President Trump's very unfortunate attempts to politicize and raise questions about the ways in which people cast their ballots, ballot boxes have now become a sort of political question and a political issue. And really what I should say is they've become a partisan question because Republicans here in Wisconsin and all around the country have tried to raise questions about their use, and have, many states have passed laws to either ban their use or to severely limit their use. And it is one more really unfortunate consequence of the way in which, not just for whom we vote, but literally how we vote, the mechanisms by which we vote have become partisan in a way they have never been before.
Looking more generally at the elections here in Wisconsin, we had this Legislative Audit Bureau report looking at the 2020 election, suggesting a bunch of changes, many of them to clarify things like ballot boxes and how witness signatures are confirmed on absentee ballots. And then we have the Gableman investigation looking into claims of wrongdoing in the election. Do you see a need for some kind of clarifications for changes in election law without necessarily diving into some of the partisan issues you were just outlining?
So, you know, Rob, I think the first thing that we should remember and that your listeners should know if they're not familiar is that the vast majority of officials who have responsibility for elections in the United States are local elections officials. The federal government has relatively broad guidelines. States and localities are the ones who administer elections. And so here in Wisconsin, like in every other place, local elected officials have a lot of sort of leeway about how they administer their elections. And so what the Audit Bureau's report suggested is that there might be circumstances where there could be clarification of language about, you know, who makes the decisions or under what conditions. Some of the criticisms of their use, you know, has been to move in a direction where the state legislature would like to have rules or laws either banning them or severely limiting them. And that would deny to local administrators of elections their control. You know, Republicans are usually about local control. And this is sort of yet another example of Republicans in the state wanting to control things at the state level when they don't like the way local officials have done them. So again, I think the problem here is the very partisan nature of this, right? The Gableman investigation continues despite the fact that there is zero evidence of any concern or any legitimate argument about the election here in Wisconsin. And all of these attempts are either trying to obfuscate or to put, you know, some veneer of credibility on what is a baseless claim.
On a related note, we've heard from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. It's a group of three Democrats, three Republicans, saying that a group of state Republican lawmakers requested large amounts of voter data. The head of the Wisconsin Election Commission said it's the largest request for data she's ever seen, would likely be impossible to complete, includes maybe some confidential voter information that they can't release. Is this just fitting into that pattern you were just talking about?
Yes, it is. I think this, so one thing about this request is that it is, you know, largely disingenuous. It is not terribly likely that these state legislators believe that having these data will help them in some way make improvements to our election system. Instead, this is an attempt to try to paralyze the Election Commission, as you say, with a request for data that they couldn't possibly ever meet because it's just so overwhelming and large. And I think it's telling that the request does not come with clear discussions of how those data would be used, because it isn't a substantive data request. This is simply one other way to try to paralyze the Election Commission, whether it's through direct lawsuits or requests for information like this.
Talking to Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at possible changes in elections and election laws here in Wisconsin and around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you would like to see in Wisconsin? Do you think it should be easy to vote absentee here in the state? Should local governments, local election officials have the ability to use drop boxes? Are there particular rules you'd like to see surrounding the use of those drop boxes at the national level? A couple of pieces of legislation stalled right now in the Senate. President Biden making a push for them. Looks like a change that would be needed. Getting rid of the filibuster on these issues, not likely to happen. Should it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look at what's happening on the national scene, starting with a listen to President Biden speaking in Atlanta earlier this week.
Protect our democracy. I support changing the Senate rules, whichever way they need to be changed to prevent a minority of senators from blocking action on voting rights.
Kathleen, that seems like a tall order. Now, one of the senators who'd have to agree to do that, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, said today, she says she supports voting changes, not getting rid of the filibuster to pass them, though. So without changing the filibuster, is anything likely to happen here?
No, honestly, it's not. As you said, if Senator Sinema is not on board with the rest of the Democrats, then it would require a Republican to work with the Democrats to change the rules of the chamber, which is pretty unlikely. And it is the case that the two bills that are in front of the Senate are both, in different ways, but are both important to making sure that all eligible Americans have access to the polls and to vote. And again, I would suggest to our listeners that when we give so much administration of elections to state and local governments, one of the things we end up having is the reality that people's abilities to vote and the circumstances under which they can vote differ simply based on where they live. So we've had 19 states already in 2021, since the 2020 election, we've had 19 states pass a myriad of laws that restrict and limit and sort of make more difficult for people the exercise of the right to vote. There are other states that have expanded the right to vote and expanded opportunities for voter registration and ballot access. We are becoming a nation, right, in which people who live in certain states have an easier time voting, and we have millions of people who live in states where it is much more difficult. And I think one of the things that President Biden was trying to articulate the other day was that those sorts of things shouldn't happen, that there should be basic national standards for the ways in which elections are administered, to make sure that everybody has at least the same level of access to voting.
And the Freedom to Vote Act, one of the two pieces of legislation stalled in the Senate, would set a lot of those standards you're talking about when it comes to how absentee voting laws work and lots of other stuff. But then there's that local control thing. Traditionally, as you were saying earlier, state and local governments take the lead on this, and there's a lot of resistance, hesitation to hand that kind of power to the federal government. Is there really a case to overcome that local control in this situation?
Well, you can have both. I think it's overly simplistic to suggest it's one or the other. At this point right now, the federal government lays standards for voting, right? You cannot abridge voting based on age or sex or race. There are broad outlines that the federal government makes, and then states and localities administer elections with those guidelines. If we were to add some administrative rules, whether it's, a consistent method of voter registration or a consistent method of absentee voting, then localities would be able to administer their elections in line with those standards. So, I guess what one thing, as I always have my students think about, and we can ask our listeners, do we want a world in which it is, almost automatic to register to vote in some states, And in other states, people have access to voter registration offices 3 hours a day, 2 days a week, and nothing online. So, you know, again, the experience, if I am somebody with the legal right to vote, should government be able to make it that hard for me, whether it's to register or to vote? And are we all entitled to some basic and baseline protections of our access to the ballot? And so localities will always administer elections, but is it that much to ask that they do it within some basic national standards?
Talking to Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at some of the latest voting news in Wisconsin and at the federal level. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In Washington, do you think Democrats should overturn the filibuster in order to get things done on two different voting laws, or should the filibuster rule remain in place? Do you agree with Democrats' proposed voting legislation? How about here in Wisconsin? Should drop boxes be available as an option for local election officials? How easy should it be to vote absentee? And you heard Kathleen's question. Should we have the same kind of voting laws, whether you live in Wisconsin or Wyoming or Washington? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Milwaukee political scientist Kathleen Dolan about voting, with debates over voting laws here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Aura is with us in Evansville. Aura, hi.
Hi. I think this whole voting rights thing is utter insanity. These legislatures passing these draconian rules to keep people from voting. I just don't understand how this can even be happening when it's a fundamental right of an American citizen to vote. And furthermore, that electoral college, you know, that makes people's votes not even count sometimes. So I think it should be a popular vote, and I think it should be administrated by the federal government.
Aura, thanks for the call. Kathleen, Aura worried, she says, about restricting votes and not wild about the electoral college either.
Yes, you know, the Electoral College mechanism for electing a president is something that we generally have conversations about every 4 years, if only because people ask why we still use it. But in the last, you know, 22 years, the Electoral College has become more present in our thinking, right? We've had two circumstances where the person who did not win the popular vote won the Electoral College vote and became president, George W. Bush in 2000 and Donald Trump in 2016. And so we ask questions all the time about whether a mechanism that was added to the Constitution in 1791 is really still the right mechanism for a country this large. And this diverse. So Aura's question is hers and a position shared by many others.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Steve in Friendship. Steve, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, how is it, can we vote some of these Republicans out of office for wasting taxpayers' money? Is there, because some of these constituents are just representing their party and not the people who they represent.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Kathleen, I think for some people that'll raise another. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, you know, Steve raises an important point on which we haven't touched yet, which is the gerrymandering, mm-hmm. the severe gerrymandering of the state legislative districts here in Wisconsin. So gerrymandering, for those who may not be familiar, is the intentional drawing of the lines of legislative districts to advantage a particular political party. And here in Wisconsin, 10 years ago, after the 2010 census, the state legislature gerrymandered the districts in such a way that they hold about 67% of the legislative seats in both chambers. And that is despite the fact that they actually have received a minority of the votes of the popular votes, if you look at votes as they're cast for Democrats and Republicans statewide. So Wisconsin is one of the most severely gerrymandered states. So it is unfortunately the case that the answer to Steve's question is that there's not a lot that people who live in districts with Republican legislators that not much they can do at this point because the sort of Republican voter to Democratic voter ratio in those districts is so lopsided. Certainly, you know, the statewide offices or governor, lieutenant governor, are places where the sort of direct popular vote can make more of a difference. But we are looking now, particularly since the state Supreme Court has said essentially that the maps they will approve will not be fundamentally different from the ones we're using now. This Republican advantage is baked in for another 10 years at least.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike next in Sun Prairie. Mike, hello.
Hello. I have a quick question. I keep hearing in the news that it's just these voting laws are being passed are disenfranchising certain groups of people, but they never really explain how. I don't understand. I mean, pretty much you have to have an ID to do anything in this world anymore. I'm hoping somebody can explain why it's disenfranchising a certain amount of people.
Thanks for the call, Mike. So voter ID and other laws, Kathleen, how do they disenfranchise if they do, say, minority voters?
Sure. So Mike raises voter ID, which is, you know, interestingly, was very controversial probably 5 to 10 years ago and actually has become sort of less visible as we focused on other things. Voter ID laws allow states to define for themselves what kind of ID is acceptable. In most states, that is often a driver's license, a military ID, a passport, something like that. The evidence suggests to us that there are ways in which it disenfranchises the elderly, the handicapped, the disabled, and minority voters, because those are people who are less likely to have a driver's license or a passport. And so states have to have mechanisms by which they can make IDs available to people so that they can vote. But that is not the easiest thing, right? I mean, having a driver's license from the time you're 16 is a lot easier than when you're 80 and you have given up your driver's license and now you have to get some other form of identification. So that speaks just very briefly to voter ID. But what I would like to address is Mike's broader question that people don't often explain how these different mechanisms can advantage or disadvantage certain groups. Voter ID, we have a lot of evidence of the impact. What I think is interesting as the use of drop boxes and early voting and other mechanisms of convenience for voters, how after the 2020 election, those have become very partisan. And by that, I mean that former President Trump saying that early voting is sketchy and drop boxes should be illegal. All of that Republican opposition to these tools that make it easier for people to vote, they have adopted a belief that those mechanisms to make things easier advantage Democrats somehow, and they have done it with absolutely zero evidence. And so the interesting thing is, if we think about an early voting period or a local drop box that makes it convenient, how is that not also convenient for Republican voters? How does that not help people in rural communities? How does that not help people who might be elderly or infirm and don't leave the house very often? November is often a bad weather time in many states, right? So if we let people vote by mail, if we let them vote a month early, there is no evidence in political science that mechanisms of convenience help or hurt one political party. And so one of the things that Republicans are running the risk of doing is starting this battle against convenient voting mechanisms without any evidence of whether it will actually help or hurt them. And so they have dangerously politicized voting without any clear understanding of the underlying issues.
Thanks for that call. And Kathleen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen Dolan is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to us today about national voting proposals, possible changes in the works here in Wisconsin, and other voting news. Keep following voting stories here in Wisconsin over at WPR.org. We talked about redistricting and gerrymandering a bit. You can find the WPR Reports podcast mapped out while you're there. Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we check in on the re-election bids for both Governor Tony Evers and U.S. Senator Ron Johnson in Wisconsin's 2022 midterms. Want to hear from you, especially the kind of issues you want to hear candidates talking about in both of those key statewide races. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.